Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Vice President and Executive Editor at DevEx. You're listening to DevEx at South by Southwest, our special edition of This Week in Global Development. The annual South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas, is known for its eclectic mix of innovators and policymakers. It's a unique place where film stars and artists co-mingle with tech entrepreneurs and social change makers to discover new ideas and spark inspiration. Increasingly, it's also become a hotspot for global development leaders looking to break out of the usual event circuit echo chamber. I'm here at South By to talk with leaders about ways that technology and innovation can supercharge the Sustainable Development Goals. Listen in for what's next in a range of sectors from food to health to climate and conflict, and how these advancements can reach the most vulnerable. In this episode, I sit down with Comfort Iroh, President and CEO of the International Crisis Group. We discuss the role of U.S. leadership in a multipolar world, the evolving nature of international alliances, and the significant impact of elections worldwide on conflict and peace. We also discuss the war in Gaza and other growing crises that don't make the headlines. She highlights the critical role of technology, including AI, in shaping future conflicts and the importance of addressing climate change as a factor in global security. Here's our conversation. Well, Comfort, thank you so much for joining me today on sidelines of South by Southwest. Now, there's a lot of predictions around with the U.S. election, which way it's going to go, and thinking about, you know, should there be a Trump presidency again, concerns around a real retreat of U.S. leadership. In that scenario, what do you think the ramifications could be on conflict and crisis globally if the U.S. were to retreat from that leadership role it's taken to date?
Yeah, so let me just step back. And I'll come back to your Trump issue. I think generally what we've been seeing, at least at Crisis Group, for the last 3 years, I mean, or even 4 years, it was very much there with Trump. And it's not necessarily hasn't gone away with Biden, which is that the landscape is changing. That the notion of multipolarity didn't emerge with Trump. Obama was also redefining the US agenda and making it clear that in the places where the US had normally had a supervisory role, had normally been the preeminent leader, even there, the US wanted to pivot from that traditional role, i.e. the Middle East, for example. A lot of concerns has been raised about sort of Trump wanting to eject the US from Europe. But even under the Obama administration and previous administration, there'd always been that message that Europe should step up, lean into its own role. And clearly, the US administration, Trump and Biden, all of them are characterized by this desire to pivot and pivot away from their traditional zones into Asia because they saw China, the China threat, the geopolitics around there. So it's not something that's specific to Trump. It's also what was there before, and it's certainly been the hallmark of Biden. And for him, it's because of Ukraine that he's had to be absorbed with Europe. Now, you know, I'm not going to get into prediction game. When we look at Trump 1.0. And that's the best way in which we can assess where he stands. But he's also made it very clear in terms of his views on NATO as well. And again, but it's not a new line. It's not new talking points from Trump. You know, he'd already indicated, already given his views on NATO. He'd already given his views on Europe and telling Europe to step up and not depend on the US. We already had a sense of his views of Russia and China. So the talking points, as I said, have not necessarily worsen. But there is real concern that this is a different Trump 2.0. He's learnt from the very first term. The cast of characters that made up his foreign policies, national security, intelligence, they will be very different. Those weren't his people. This time it will be his people, and they have a very clear view. Now, I don't know if you got the readout from the Munich Security Conference. J.D. Vance, who everybody already is sort of the senator, everybody's sort of looking at as, you know, sort of the, if there was a successor, you know, where would he be on there? He was sort of given a sense of what the Trump foreign policy would be like. And again, it's very much what we sort of suspected, which is that, again, Europe don't depend on the US. Our interest is China and Taiwan, and that we have bigger sort of stakes and interest in Asia and the geopolitics around there. To be fair, Biden himself, you know, when you look at the alliance building that he's been doing around the Quad, around AUKUS, you know, with India as well, it's already laying the foundation for where that pivot is taking place. So in a sense, there's continuity, but there's a real fear, real anxiety, and real nervousness. And I think some parts of Europe are only beginning to appreciate that there's going to be a real difference. And these are Trump's people, and they have a very clear agenda in terms of what they want. And yeah, it's going to be quite heady.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Gaza and, you know, what you think about the recent, you know, airdrops in the U.S., the plan to build a maritime corridor, which can take months to get supplies that are needed now. What are you all thinking about this approach, and what would you like to see?
Look, I think there's the general sense of just disappointment that at the cost, you know, the amount of civilians that have died as a result of this, this doesn't, will not change the trajectory that the Netanyahu government is taking. And we've seen the way in which the government itself has sort of had limits on movement of any form of aid coming into the strip, you know, sort of excessive hours, 2 hours inspection, making sure that things that make, you know, having clear limits on what can go in, because, you know, tin of food, you never know, it could be used for some kind of weaponry that gives Hamas an advantage. Let me step back and, you know, just make it clear that, of course, there's an understanding, that, and certainly within crisis group, of the just very horrible circumstances in which Israel faced, and the need for, you know, the right to defend its people. And the horror story that has come out of there. But the objectives that it laid for itself, and how far can your objectives of degrading, you know, disrupting, destroying Hamas go without completely raising Gaza? And I think that's the real challenge. And I think what is even more glaring is that there's real clear water between what Biden thinks he can sort of achieve in terms of influencing and shaping and nudging the Israeli government, and the plans of Netanyahu himself as well. So I think a number of people are skeptical, but better late than never. I mean, if some of that aid can make a difference, but, you know, I have my doubts. You just said it yourself, you know, how many months before the floating port comes through? And why a port? Why can't you just get trucks in there? Why can't you insist that these trucks are coming in? Why can't you have something that's a little bit more sturdy, more robust, and more, and just, but we are where we are, and that decision by the president doesn't change his overall outlook, which is to continue to have this sort of insisting that Israel can continue unconditionally with its policy that it's a wrecking game right now in Gaza.
And what do you think about the future UNRWA and like whether, you know, other agencies, WFP, IOM, UNICEF, can take over, replace it, which is what some are proposing. You know, what are you hearing and seeing on the future of that agency?
I mean, you need an infrastructure, and that infrastructure is UNRWA. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've spoken to them yourselves. They will tell you that we can't do what we're doing. We can't supply the assistance that we need. We can't provide those humanitarian provisions or do the work without some kind of infrastructure. So for all the talk about, you know, defunding UNRWA, what are you going to replace it with that ultimately looks different? Also, on the other side, Netanyahu has been very clear that he's not interested in seeing a revitalized UNRWA, because UNRWA perpetuates the very one thing that he's against, which is the idea that the Palestinians are refugees and the right to return. He just wants them to sort of disappear and go elsewhere. So that itself becomes a challenge to him. But a number of important donors are beginning to come back on stream. Of course, there are others, and we know who they are. But this is a death knell. I mean, if you're going to do humanitarian assistance and you think that you can do it outside of that framework, and you're asking the UN, that's already under a lot of strain, under a lot of challenges, both, you know, the day-to-day bombings and the realities in Gaza, the very tense relationships with Israel, and then the politics back in New York, you put an excessive degree of burden on a body that is supposed to be trying to save lives. And I don't understand why you think that you can provide that kind of assistance without some kind of architecture, and why you think that architecture would look radically different from UNRWA as well. So I think we need to sort of go back to the drawing books on this.
Yeah, and so, you know, thinking about what comes next, can you imagine a scenario in which Palestinians are, you know, forced to flee into Sinai?
Well, you can imagine all sorts of scenarios. Yeah. You can imagine all sorts of scenarios. You know, don't forget, we're also dealing with a leader, a government that has also made it clear that it doesn't subscribe to the two-state solution. So that logically means that you want to clear Gaza of, you know, clear and make sure that Gaza becomes secure. I mean, look, the dilemma, and it's one we certainly appreciate in Crisis Group, for so long as you can't answer that question about what to do with Hamas, then everything else then becomes very difficult to think about. I mean, it's partly also why we sort of very early on in the crisis, I think on the 18th of October, that we called for a ceasefire, not for humanitarian reasons. People think, oh yeah, ceasefire, humanitarian. No, it was a lot complicated than that. It was about the politics as well. It was about whether the objectives that Israel had outlined could be met, and laying down the steps and saying, look, it's going to be very hard to meet this objective of destroying Hamas, because to destroy Hamas requires you to destroy Gaza. And then there's a security conundrum as well. Again, appreciating that it's, you know, if you don't have an answer to that dilemma for Israel, but it was also about beginning to think very carefully about what a ceasefire can deliver. Now, you know, we are now in this new situation where there have been talks for some time now in Cairo and Paris, and, you know, the various personalities involved in that left Paris, and everybody was hoping that there would be some kind of ceasefire to accompany the Ramadan period. But neither side is comfortable with what's on the table. For Hamas, it wants an end of the fighting. For Israel, they want the release of the hostages. And Israel wants a temporary ceasefire as well. So you can see that just getting a meeting of minds becomes very, very difficult. And then trying to think through what a future could look like, how you put in an interim arrangement to deal with governance, to bring infrastructure back into the country, and then restoring that sense of security that Israel desperately needs. It's very complex, it's very challenging. But the other question that I think we also have to ask candidly is that could all of this have been avoided?
If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already working in global development, or maybe you're thinking about carving out a new path in the social impact space. Regardless, we all need a little help sometimes in our pursuit of a happy, fulfilling, and impactful work life, whether you're actively searching for a new role or looking for some pointers on how to strike a healthier work-life balance. I'm Justin Sablich, DevEx's careers editor, and each Friday in the Career Hub newsletter, I'll bring you inside the minds of leading career coaches and recruiters to help you navigate the next step of your professional journey. You'll also have access to the latest hiring and salary trends and a weekly dose of the best leads from Global Development's largest job board. Visit devx.com/careerhub to subscribe.
You have your crisis watch to track conflicts worldwide. Obviously, Gaza has taken up a lot of the international attention, and for a very good reason. Ukraine maybe has fallen a little behind that.
Ironic, isn't it?
But you know, those are not the only conflicts happening. So, what are some other areas where you feel like there needs to be more international attention to, and how do you think about, you know, when we have so many of these going on, where to prioritize, whether it's attention or headlines and media, but also funding and resources?
Yeah, so the attention narrative is interesting to me, but it's also not just attention, but consistency in the engagement as well. And it speaks to the fact that there's just so many conflicts. There's so much fight. You know, the numbers aren't going down. They're going up. Never has it been so stark. In the time that I've been a crisis group. But let me put them in certain categories. So you've got the situation in Sudan, where, for me, it's not that a lack of actors. It's just getting all those actors to agree on the best way forward and making sure that all those with key, clear interests, and you'll understand what I mean, that the enablers, those who've long held the pen on Sudan, those who have a clear interest in what kind of state emerges, getting them on the table. Now, you know, we've got two new envoys in the room now. One is the personal envoy of the SG Guterres, so the former foreign minister of Algeria, Lamamra, who's widely regarded, heavily respected. He used to lead the Africa Union Commission, so highly regarded. So hopefully his own personal connections in the region, the Horn of Africa, but also into the Gulf, might play a significant role. Crisis Group, the last year or so, has been advocating for the US to upgrade its own diplomacy. And to get a dedicated envoy. So now we have the announcement of Tom Perriello, who comes with a lot of credibility. He was the envoy for the Great Lakes, you know, well-regarded politician, will understand how to negotiate some very difficult things. So let's see whether, but it's not a silver bullet. You know, there's still the hard work of making sure there's a better alignment, you know, loosely coordinated among the key mediators. The other conflict, as we speak, you know, the South by Southwest opened when things went dramatically in the wrong direction in Haiti. You know, and we were talking in the panel yesterday, if you recall, that this is a moment where, you know, just more speed and more pace, you know, and more resources is needed, because you had Kenya in Africa deciding that it would lead an international intervention, and yet, you know, getting more troops to support, police to be involved in that, and then getting the resources. If you don't get the resourcing, and then if you don't define the clear political agenda of what must accompany that deployment, and then convincing and urging Prime Minister Henri and others to move towards a transitional government. So you need that political sort of pressure And then making sure that security umbrella in the form of the Kenyan police deployment happen rapidly now. I mean, you know, you could see that this was going to, I mean, we said it anyway in crisis group, that this was the scenario that was going to confront Haiti sooner or later until we had a clear political agenda with a clear message that we needed to shift towards a transitional government. And you saw Henri himself was wavering on the elections, which then sparked all sorts of predictable outcomes as well. So that's the other one that I would put. And for crisis group, we had put Haiti on our 10 conflicts to watch for 3 years in a row because we could see what was coming down the line. Now, there are other conflicts, you know, Myanmar, very entrenched. You know, I think getting China to play sort of a more leading role there, especially after we saw sort of the rebellion that was emerging last year, and you know the military sort of got, it was a wake up call and realizing that you know that they don't have the solid footing. But China becomes a key actor there. Yemen, you know, that becomes harder now with what's happening on the Red Sea, and Afghanistan. You know, how do you engage and work with the Taliban to avert, you know, a further humanitarian catastrophe? I could go on. The list is depressingly long, and it's attention, it's bandwidth, it's capacity, but it's also just staying engaged, you know, on all these files. They're more wars, not less, and that is what sort of keeps me up at night.
Yeah, and
as
a
well.
Trend line is, you know, climate. Is exacerbating, yeah. And what are you seeing, and particularly your data on how climate is driving some of these, and potentially driving more in the future?
I mean, I think it's one of the drivers. I haven't seen yet a direct sort of link between climate and a particular conflict, but it's certainly a factor in one area that Crisis Group certainly has invested in. I mean, we created a Future of Conflict program under my predecessor. Rob Marley, and one of the innovations, you know, was on climate and specifically climate security. And we are building out this platform now called eEarth, kind of like environmental early warning tracking hub, that marries political, what Crisis Group does really well with political analysis, marrying that with data and science, and giving a number of conflict-affected countries, particularly the capacity to better monitor, but also donors, governments, to better monitor, but also to, not just to monitor, but to have the appropriate response, and especially in a conflict setting as well. And a good example is when, you know, citizens flee from one part, drought-affected, flood-affected area in South Sudan, and whether they flee into a conflict zone as well, and understanding the consequences and being able to build a resilient system that allows donors to readjust their programming. But also, you know, I went to my first COP28 in Dubai. You know, and Crisis Group signed up to the Peace, Relief and Recovery Declaration that the government had been pursuing. Primarily because for us, our main area is conflict-affected countries. Of the 17 sort of low-income countries, 10 of them are conflict-affected, and 10 of them have some serious climatic issues. Sudan, Somalia, right at the top of that as well. So it was very clear to us that, great, we secured the loss and damage, but if you're going to deal with this conundrum of, you know, climate in very vulnerable places, you've got to also deal with resilience and adaptation, and I think we've still got a way to go. But you know, I'm glad we made this investment because you know it's very clear to us. You know, when you look at somewhere like Somalia, you know, drought, famine, the capacity of the government to respond. You know, Al-Shabaab effectively creating a proto-state. You know, making itself sort of the arbiter. And you know the choices then that citizens have, that they have to engage with Al-Shabaab to deal with, you know, famine and drought becomes, you know, sort of a reality of the climate. And then you've got a lot of climate refugees as well that are flowing either from Somalia or South Sudan and in the Sahel and you begin to see the challenges, Nigeria, the herd of farmer tensions. So this is a reality and explains why Crisis Group got engaged in this area and trying to improve our own working methodology.
Yeah. So I feel like you can't be at South by Southwest without talking about AI.
Apparently not really.
I think it's a requirement in every conversation. Okay. So, you know, how were you thinking about AI, other technology, whether it's from tracking these platforms you're building, looking at predictive analysis, is that something that you're thinking about? And then maybe more broadly, what do you see as the opportunities and maybe even some of the challenges as AI gets expanded more globally?
I mean, I don't think you've got a choice but to engage. I mean, also a smart organization that, you know, has an ambition, is always being creative and innovative. And, you know, as with all things, you know, that humanity creates, there's always a double-edged sword. You know, it's both positive and negative. And we're focused on both, you know, and as with every organization, you are asking yourself how you use this tool transparently and honestly, and making sure that colleagues know that you're using those tools. But be aware also of the dangers of those tools. It's partly because because it still remains an unknown entity, and it's come at a time also of just heightened geopolitical tensions. And one of the things feeding into the tensions is also technological advances of certain countries, so the China, US, you know, the semiconductor, autonomous weapons, and now you add AI into that mix. It's partly because of that environment that we at Crisis Group inserted how the UN itself can play a role in helping define guiding principles or some kind of regulatory framework to understand, to make sure there was equity also and transparency as various countries build out their systems. So we put it in our sort of 10 challenges for the new General Assembly to take on board and think about, because you could already see the unevenness and the disadvantage, but you could also already see how countries like China and the US, you know, in that struggle, in that race to the bottom or race to be advanced, how that then sort of raises a lot of suspicion, but also could cause a degree of miscalculations as well. So it's based on that we both see the positive elements of AI and how it could make you sort of more efficient in your work, but the reality of how that plays out in an already tense geopolitical environment when states themselves are competing and making sure that they're putting themselves in an advantaged position itself can cause tension. So from a conflict prevention lens, that's why we are now engaging with it all under our Future of Conflict program. So climate change is under our Future of Conflict program, war and technology. We spent a great deal of time initially looking at social media, you know, Facebook, X, Twitter. And then the third pillar is the economics of conflict. And they all sort of merge and integrate in different ways as well.
So you deal with every day a lot of heavy topics. Yeah. What gives you, you know, hope in the work that you do?
What gives me hope? I think just knowing that across the world, you know, there are 160 or so people committed to this one single mission. All 160 look for a very pragmatic pathway to trying to, you know, create sort of a platform, a template, solutions. And, you know, we are aware of how difficult, you know, it is to nudge various actors into the right direction as well. But, you know, we believe in it, and I think that's what gives me hope. In a sense, Crisis Group was made for this moment. Our job is to find the political will and to create ideas in the beyond the headlines and to get away from the noise and to quietly try to thread the needle in a very complex and a very dangerous world. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
No, thank you.
And,
I appreciate it.
It's great to catch up. Thanks for listening to DevEx at South by Southwest, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it, or you can also leave us a rating or a review. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform. If you want to share feedback on this episode or have any questions you'd like answered, we'd love to hear from you. Drop me a message on social media at Kate D. Warren or send an email to podcast@devx.com. DevEx at South by Southwest is a podcast from DevEx. It's hosted by me, Kate Warren. Today's episode was produced by Catherine Cheney and edited by Naomi Mihara.